Okay, so Dr. Mohamed Omar Rahman will make a presentation on the longitudinal data in developing countries. He's a former professor at the School of Public Health at Harvard.
Thank you. Basically, what I'm going to talk about are the following things. Why should we care about longitudinal data to begin with, particularly in developing countries? What are the different kinds and levels of longitudinal data? What are the current constraints and challenges in terms of collecting longitudinal data? And basically spend most of my presentation talking about what we think is a new approach towards increasing accessibility and improving sustainability in terms of longitudinal data in developing countries, developed by my university, independent university in Bangladesh, and then end up with some conclusions. All right, I mean, I'm basically preaching to the choir here, but I think it's worth repeating that longitudinal data is crucial for teasing out the cause and effects of any kind of health model. And in fact, part of the problem is that we don't have very much longitudinal data, both in developed and developing countries, because it's difficult to collect and there's a lot of logistic issues involved, and primarily it's there's a lot of problems with funding in terms of sustaining it. Basically, what the slide tells you is that there are certain kinds of structural problems in modeling which can only be addressed by longitudinal data. I mean, if you've omitted variables, the issues of endogeneity, particularly important chronic disease follow-up with long lag times, which have become particularly important right now in the developing country context because of the epidemiological transition. Chronic diseases are a huge part of the health landscape, which was not true even, say, 30 years ago. And lastly, but not least, longitudinal data is essential for evaluating interventions. If you want to find out whether something works or doesn't work, you're going to have an intervention, have a control area, and then just follow people over time to see whether it makes a difference or not. All right, so now there are different kinds of follow-ups, and it's important because it has certain implications for logistics and also for funding. The usual sense that people have of longitudinal data is that it's a cohort study. We take a group of people defined at a particular point in time, and we follow them over time. So here the issue that comes up often is what do you do with exit? Somebody leaves the area. Obviously, somebody dies, the study stops at that point. But if somebody leaves the area for migration purposes or marries out of the area or just for any other reason, how far do you go in terms of following them up? These are not easy issues to resolve. And in most studies, what has happened is that they're just considered to be lost to follow up because of logistic constraints in terms of following them up. Now, there's another approach, which is basically the approach that is followed by population laboratories, which are very expensive, and there are a few around, the most important of which is the Matlab Health and Matlab Population Laboratory in Bangladesh, which has been in existence now for 40 years. They have taken a defined area of about 144 villages, 200,000 people, they visit each household. Essentially, there's about 40,000 households. They visit each household every 2 weeks. Very, very intensive follow-up, but the amount of data that's collected is very sparse. It's basically what we call demographic data on age and demographic events like births, deaths, migrations, and marriages. So it's just dates of events that are collected, but in a very precise way over a very, very large population. Now, the issue about population laboratories is that they're basically making a commitment to follow both entries, which are easy because these are people who are born into the households, and people who come into the household for marriage or for in-migration, and exits. But even in these population laboratories, generally speaking, all that they do in terms of exits is that they record the date of the exit, whether it's by death, when there's a natural stop to the follow-up, or for out-migration. They don't actually follow the people outside of the surveillance area. Now, the levels of data, generally speaking, most data sets have focused on both individual level data, which then there's also some household level data. And I want to introduce this issue of family, because in a developing country context, that's different than household. In most developed country data sets, the household is really seen as the decision-making agent, and we collect information on everybody who's in the household at a particular point in time. The notion of family, especially in certain parts of the developing world, is that they're decision-makers who may be making decisions who don't live in the same household, who may be living in adjacent households, or in the case of rural urban migrants, may be living far away, but they have important impacts on the decision-making that happens in the household. So it's very important to collect information on people who are not present in the household, but who are connected to it. Now, this is a particular problem because it adds to the logistic complexity of the data collection, but it has some conceptual relevance, particularly in the developing country context. Lastly, there's the whole issue of community. I mean, what defines a community? In a rural area, I mean, generally speaking, we use the definition of the village boundary as a community, and we try to collect information. In an urban setting, it's much more complicated because you can define a neighborhood, but there are lots of services that people go that utilize outside the neighborhood. They may, you know, for example, there may be a hospital serving 5 or 6 neighborhoods, so therefore, you know, there may not be a hospital in the neighborhood per se, but clearly that's not an issue because people are using it from lots of different points. So there are some definitional problems and there are some issues which impinge on what kinds of information you want to collect at the community level. You sort of have to make a decision about whether you want to just focus on things which are physically present within a geographical area or whether you want to collect information on services that are used by people in that area, regardless of where the physical location is. All right, now, the types of data, you know, generally speaking, there are essentially 2 broad categories of data collection. You know, there is, you know, data collection which is based on responses to some kind of a questionnaire, whatever the content may be, and then there are measurements. And the measurements could be biomarkers, like blood, urine, saliva samples. There could be environmental samples. There is now, of course, a growing field of GPS measurements and GIS measurements. And then, of course, photographic images and so on. So the range of measurements has actually, as technology has progressed, has increased tremendously. And there's a lot of amazing potential in terms of actually getting a much better fix on things because these are objective. I mean, the real advantage of measurements is that they're objective and then they don't have what we call respondent bias. Okay, so what are the current constraints and challenges of longitudinal data, particularly in the context of developing countries? I mean, some of these are, of course, generic. I mean, they don't just apply to developing countries. Is that, you know, this is a whole issue of frequency of follow-up. How often should you go back to these respondents, these households, these communities? The more close the follow-up it is, the more expensive it is, the more logistically problematic it is. And it's, from a logistic point of view, it's very difficult for any group to do frequent follow-up because it means keeping and maintaining a survey infrastructure, which is, you know, not cheap. You've got to have people, you know, like surveyors who are on, you know, basically who you're hiring throughout the year. And these are not cheap things to sustain, and they're also logistically difficult. The other big problem that happens is that most longitudinal data is proprietary because people invest a lot of resources in collecting the data, and there's a strong sense that if we've invested the money to get it, it's ours and that we are going to hold on to it. And that is true both in the developed world and in the developing world, but you know, NIH has been trying for many years to try to make a lot of longitudinal data, especially social science data, basically public use. This, because it's the funding comes from NIH, they can mandate it. This is, however, not true for biomarker data. I mean, the tradition in the U.S. and Canada and most of the developed world has been that biomarker data is generally considered proprietary and that you have to get permission from the original group that collected it and work with them. So the net result of all of this is that most longitudinal data isn't used. I mean, there are estimates that only about 10 to 15% of data that's collected is actually used because, you know, I mean, it's not hard to see why. I mean, the original data collection group that started it, you know, they published their first few papers and they move on to other things, but they still don't give other people access to the data because there's a sense in which that the data is a kind of asset which needs to be preserved. The third issue is that now that data collection is happening over a range of not only of levels but also types of data, different kinds of expertise are needed, and it's becoming harder and harder for any one group to have the whole range of expertise from biomarker processing to GIS to, you know, whatever, what have you. And the final point is the one that I've mentioned, is that most data collection is project-based and not always sustainable once the money runs out. Oftentimes what is seen, which is very unfortunate, is very good data collection systems essentially stop. Because at some point the funding priorities change and people don't have the wherewithal to carry this on. All right, so what I'm presenting here is an attempt to try to get around two of the major constraints of longitudinal data collection, one of which is sustainability and the other of which is public use. What we are trying to do as an independent university, is a private university, it's about 3,500 students in two campuses in Bangladesh. One of the requirements of graduation are that all students have to spend a period of time between 2 to 3 weeks in a rural an urban community trying to understand about the community. Now, what was happening over the last 10 to 15 years, and this is an enterprise that has been going on for quite some time, is that students would go out, they would go study these communities, they would write up a detailed report, and this report would get shelved in the library. You could get access to it, but the question is, would at some point be just thrown out, because every 6 months a new group of students would go. And there was no systematic archiving, there was no electronic database. So there was no way of tracking what changes have happened. So when I first went to independent university about 5 years ago, I was very intrigued by the fact that you had this structure where you were using students as part of a defined course to collect data, and it gives you a certain kind of leverage to keep on collecting it sort of ad infinitum, because it's a course. People are going, they're trying to collect data, they're writing up these reports. So what we've decided to do, and we've just piloted the first phase of this, is we basically take 300 students every 6 months in five locations. So there are five distinct locations, both urban and rural, in different geographical parts of Bangladesh. I should point out that this is not a multi-stage stratified nationally representative sites because of logistic reasons, because you've got to find places where you can house, you know, 70 students, their faculty members, and so on. But they are geographically distinct, and there is a certain amount of not only about geographic variation but also socioeconomic variation. There's also rural, urban, and peri-urban sites. So there is variation, and the best way to think about it is that there are five distinct sites with quite a bit of variation, but they're not in the statistical sense truly nationally representative. So there are five cohorts, five communities that are being followed. And our goal, and one important goal, for example, is in terms of choosing the site. As people, I'm sure, are aware, I mean, this is, climate change has become a huge issue, and Bangladesh is really in the eye of the storm. There is a real concern that in 30 years, if the sea level rises by 30 centimeters, somewhere between 20% of the southern coastal belt of Bangladesh may become flooded. So there is a lot of interest in trying to understand how communities are preparing, or whether they are preparing to adapt to this kind of low probability but high impact event. So one particular site that we are following up is going to be a coastal site, which we hope to follow over the next few decades to see how the community adapts to the possibility of major inundation and flooding. All right, so just to recap, there are five locations with 60 students, so 30 pairs. The pairs are usually one female student, one male student. There is a student monitor and a faculty member for every 20 students. Each pair is expected to cover two households a day, so 60, and then they're there for about 10 days in three different villages, so, urban locations as well, depending on whether it's an urban. So ultimately, what we are hoping to do is collect information on 300 households, and because the household size is about 5 in Bangladesh and about 15,000 individuals. So, a fairly large data set. The advantages of this are that what we're going to do is, obviously use a structured questionnaire. The students are given a week of intensive training. The data is collected at individual, household, family, and community level. And we will be collecting, as we go along, information on the community, which will include GIS and videography and other kinds of information. The data will be collected by students, but will be entered professionally. This is partly one of the lessons we've learned from the pilot. We originally were hoping to use students to both collect the data and enter it using a modified, simplified data entry template. Turned out that it was students, while they enjoyed collecting data, did not enjoy the fairly tedious aspect of entering the data in a structured format and the whole data entry. And it became quite a problematic issue. And so what we've decided really is that because that aspect, the quality part, is very important, that we don't have data entry errors and so on, that we will use professional data entry people. Fortunately, data entry is relatively cheap in Bangladesh, so it's still a viable proposition financially for us to use data entry people to enter the data. And of course, we are going to be experimenting with various kinds of data entry software checks to make sure that they aren't out of range values and so on. You know, the usual things that people are doing. Okay, now, when we first broached this idea, there were a lot of people who were very wary of it. I mean, part of the whole issue here was people said that you're using relatively inexperienced students to they're untrained, inexperienced students to collect data. And there was a concern that the data quality would suffer. Now, we did do extensive piloting, and we have found that if you have a relatively structured questionnaire where there are few open-ended questions, which is true for most data entry, most surveys anyway, that the error rates are not huge. There are things that can be checked. We are going to have a field supervisor checking it and so on. So, I mean, the bottom line is we found that students, remember, these are students who are seniors. They are obviously well-educated and so on. They may not know much about rural life, but, you know, they're obviously, all of them are highly educated. And in some sense, the typical surveyor there is not as well educated as the typical student, which has its pluses and minuses. So, but our experience has been that this is a viable proposition, that with adequate faculty supervision, students can collect structured information without too much of a problem. Okay, and the other issue, of course, is that there is no institutional memory other than the faculty monitors, because every time you get a new set of students. But that's true in any kind of longitudinal data collection to begin with. It's not always the case that you have the same surveyors. You'd like that because, you know, there is kind of a learning curve and people become better at it. But generally speaking, there's quite a high turnover in the survey field to begin with. Okay, so what's new about the IUB approach? The first part is that we are using students to collect data. This is a sustainable approach because this is part of a course. This is part of a graduation requirement. It's not that something that is subject to funding constraints or, you know, the project runs out so that we stop the data collection and so on. We are using a large number of students anywhere. I mean, right now we graduate about 600 students a year. As the student body increases, this will in fact grow, and we may actually be able to increase the number of sites that we go to. The second part, so it's sustainable as part of a normal educational activity. The second part of it is, and I want to spend a little bit of time dwelling on it, is what we have decided is to archive the data and give it away for free. Now, this is something that people don't do. And the reason we're sort of taking a leaf out of the open source computing literature, and the notion is the only way this data is going to be useful is if people use it. The only way that people are going to use it, if you make it easy for people to use it. And because there's a huge volume of data and we don't have the capability to check through everything. Just as in the open source computing idea, we are drawing on this notion that if we give it away for free, which means putting it up on a website and letting anyone download it, what we are hoping is that people will actually collaborate with us, that they don't have to. I mean, you can just download the data and then you can start working with it. But even if you were to do that and if you were looking through it and if you found problems, you would get in touch with us and we would be able to identify errors and so on. So this is kind of an experimental notion which we are calling the Open Source Data Project. That if we give away the data for free, we are hoping that lots of groups around the world will actually want to work with it and will bring into it their own kinds of expertise. So if you have a group that's very interested in GIS approaches to community mapping, they may want to work with us and say, let's try to find and create an architecture that makes it much more useful and much more dynamic. And of course, the quid pro quo is they get the data. But so does everybody else. And that's the whole point, is that it's data that's available to, you know, so there is a real, I mean, in a sense, there's a bit of a free rider problem that you may develop all this sort of architecture for GIS mapping and people get to, and we may need to work out a modality where maybe there's a lag time that you get access for 2 years and then you have to open it up. So we are open to those suggestions. But I think what is interesting is that this is an approach which ironically really has not been tried anywhere. No one has actually given away data. I mean, usually there are these NIH-funded data sets which are, you know, but they're not really, you know, in a sustainable sense. I mean, they collect the data and after a certain lag time, you can get access to it. The DHS surveys, for example, are available free, but they're basically cross-sectional surveys. So what we are hoping is that we want groups to work with us to bring in new kinds of expertise and to try to make the data set much more robust. Now, the other aspect is that the frequent visits allow people to do, to add new modules. So, you know, we have a basically a demographically oriented database which gets updated every 6 months. Now, let's say you want to do something with biomarkers. You can come in and say, I want to do a study on biomarkers, I'm interested in cytokines and asthma, or whatever it is. And then you'd have to raise some funds for that. But because we're going into the community every 6 months, you can actually do primary data collection on a fairly restricted module and get the benefit of all this data. Just talking to someone earlier on today that one of the problems that graduate students often face in PhD dissertations is that they're expected oftentimes to collect primary data, and it's very difficult to do that because primary data collection takes a lot of time, a lot of costs, and you know the whole panoply of other information that's needed to make it a useful data set often doesn't exist. So you're interested in cytokines, but you're also interested in knowing all the socioeconomic data. So we are hoping that this frequent follow-up, which allows people to add in new modules, will allow people to test out lots of new things, which currently is not possible in any other structure. And of course, the wide range of data, I mean, it's not just biomedical or health or environment data. It's really actually data over a wide, whatever it is that people are interested in. You can construct your own module. You can be interested in depression. You can be interested in marriage. Whatever it is that you want to do, you know, you get in touch with us. The next cycle is, you know, between 0 to 6 months away. We can put it into the field, and we can talk about ways in which this data is useful for everyone. Okay, so what are we hoping? That the wide access to the data will make it used much more than if it were proprietary. As I mentioned, that we hope that we can benefit from data checking by different groups of users, and so there is a process of continuous improvement. And because of group ownership, we can get technical help from different sources, you know, different kinds of expertise. So this is an ambitious agenda. I mean, ambitious in the sense that this is a new idea. We don't know whether how well it will work. We've just done the first pilot. We've proven that we can use the students to collect data. Whether by putting it up on the web, we'll get lots of groups to work on it, we don't know, but the preliminary response we've gotten from various groups that we've talked about has been quite positive. Different groups have become interested in trying to work on different aspects of data collection. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Rahman.